loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, at a meeting with U.S. industry officials at the White House, President Trump vowed to rebuild American steel and aluminum industries, saying that they had been treated unfairly by other countries for decades. Next, Wall Street bankers are pushing for a significant loosening of the Volcker Rule, a part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that restricts certain kinds of speculative investments that do not benefit bank customers. Then, President Trump told a group of senators yesterday that he favored stronger background checks for gun purchasers and was open to the idea of raising to 21 the age necessary to buy a gun. The National Rifle Association, in the meantime, was lobbying hard on Capitol Hill to either kill or water down any new firearm legislation. And then, Russian President Vladimir Putin today laid out his key policies ahead of a presidential election that he's expected to win in 17 days. He also made the bombshell announcement that Russia has developed a cruise missile that can reach anywhere in the world, carry a nuclear warhead, and is impossible to shoot down. And finally, White House Communications Director Hope Hicks resigned yesterday, hours after testifying on Capitol Hill in the Russia investigation. Hicks is only one of more than two dozen senior White House officials who have resigned in the past year. Meanwhile, Attorney General Sessions responded tersely to President Trump's angry tweet about his handling of the investigation and to Trump's comparison of Sessions to the cartoon character Mr. Magoo. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to trade. At a meeting with U.S. industry officials at the White House today, President Trump vowed to rebuild American steel and aluminum by imposing a tariff of 25% on steel imports and 10% on imported aluminum next week. He says that those industries have been treated unfairly by other countries for decades. We're joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the world's first crowdfunded economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Steve, Brian and I were talking off the air a moment ago saying this doesn't make any economic sense, but it sure will make Donald Trump popular in Pennsylvania. What do you think about this decision?
If he actually goes ahead with it, the last piece of news I saw said it was being stopped, is that it's both sensible and stupid, which seems to be a usual combination with Trump, because the argument that free trade is not the best system for welfare in general is empirically strong. All the arguments that free trade is better for you simply don't hold up to empirical analysis, despite what economists claim in theory. And in this particular thing, Trump's got his finger on the pulse in a way that he seems peculiarly capable of doing. But of course, he often puts his finger on the pulse and strangles the patient. And that's my little concern here, that while it does make sense to say that you should try to develop your own industry's investment matters more than specialization, this sort of move could trigger a lot of costs for firms, because when they set up their supply chains, getting that supply chain disrupted is not good. And of course, many, many other industries depend upon steel. And it may be that the local manufacturers can't supply the grades of steel that are needed for quite a few manufacturing processes in the States. So it's going to cause all sorts of warfare at the manufacturing level. But of course, it will be very popular in what is very advisedly called the Rust Belt these days.
And tell me, how is this permitted? How are these tariffs permitted under the WTO? Can there be some kind of a reaction through the WTO from affected countries, South Korea, China, Japan, for example?
There can be, but what often happens is the argument will be that there's some predatory behavior by firms dumping steel on the global market, you know, pricing steel for export for less than they price steel for domestic consumption, that sort of thing. If that can be proven, then you're allowed to get away with these tariffs to fight against predatory trade behavior. But if that's not the case, if you can't actually prove that, then the WTO can tell you to remove the tariffs and put penalties on you on the other side. Now, of course, penalizing the biggest gorilla in the cage is rather difficult.
When you look at the countries that are exporting steel to the United States, number one is Canada, number two is Brazil, three is South Korea, four is Mexico, five is Turkey, six is Japan, seven is Russia, eight is Germany, Taiwan and Vietnam are ninth and tenth. you have to get to number 11 before you get China. And yet a big part of the Trump campaign rhetoric was against China. And of course, China was identified by Trump in his State of the Union address as a, quote, rival, close quote, signaling some degree of apprehension, I think, in China, although they won't be surprised by that. It seems, though, that the real targets of this, those that might be hurt most, would be principal U.S. allies. Of the first four, it's Canada, South Korea, and Mexico. What about that?
Yeah, that's not exactly the effect that Trump would have desired. He would have preferred China to be at the top. He probably thinks China is at the top.
He probably does.
Yeah, but the reality is that China uses steel for its domestic needs, the dramatic expansion of infrastructure in China, and for building the Silk Road. So pumping some stuff over to America is far less important to them. They're more interested in pumping over semiconductors and computers and so on, which Trump is not about to put a ban on, because his support base is not people who make semiconductors.
Well, and speaking of his support base too, I'm looking at the it's a list of the locations of aluminum smelters here in the United States. And frankly, they're all states that either Donald Trump won or wants to win. Indiana, Washington State, New York, which he lost handily, South Carolina, Texas, Kentucky, West Virginia, Montana, Missouri, and Ohio. I can't help but to think that this was done for purely political reasons rather than economic ones.
That's the way Trump thinks. It's score settling. It's trying to shore up a strength for the next election. It's winning, and he puts it, it's not necessarily performing.
Steve Keen is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Steve Keen, will there be a trade war? And what is a trade war? I think most people, you know, we hear the term trade war, but I think most people in the public, most lay people, don't know what that means, what that looks like, and who the winners and losers are, because, of course, there's such an interconnected world economy that you would presume that a trade war, even if, as you're saying, free trade per se, the doctrine or the mantra of free trade is the solver of all problems, is false, a trade war will have economic consequences. What are they?
Oh, yeah, well, for a start, firms that have currently got, you know, costings based on paying 20 or 30% less than they would pay after a price change are going to be forced to absorb the loss that implies, or to some extent put their prices up. They'll more likely absorb the losses than they will put the prices up. That tends to be the way firms behave when they get costs changes thrown at them by international trade policy changes. So there'd be a decline in profitability. There'd be firms looking to resource their iron for steel from other locations. And the problem there is that quite a fantastic old Australian ad about oil, which is oils ain't oils, steel ain't steel. There's enormous grade differences and enormous quality differences in steel from different suppliers. And this will cause mayhem for manufacturing. So there'll be lots of people in manufacturing pulling their hair out, but I've got a feeling most of those people don't vote for Trump. But in terms of how it fills domestically, it won't be that as drastic as it might sound, because first of all, people have got stocks in hand of this material. They've got existing materials they can draw on. There'll be cost increases, but some countries, like for example Australia, that don't produce much steel, might find the price of steel they pay falling, because all these producers are suddenly cut out of the major markets they sell to, are going to be trying to find other venues. So it'll be more chaos than it will be killing economies. But chaos seems to be the state of mind that Donald Trump prefers the most.
And I can't help but to think, too, that this is not something that's going to go away quickly. He's essentially declared a trade war on so many of our friends and allies. And this is something that now is going to have to play out, and it's probably going to take years. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from London by Steve Keen, the author of Debunking Economics and the World's First Crowdfunded Economist. You can check out his work at patreon.com/Prof. Steve Keen. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Wall Street bankers are pushing for a significant loosening of the Volcker Rule, a part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that restricts certain kinds of speculative investments that do not benefit bank customers. We're joined from London by Brad Birkenfeld. Brad is a whistleblower who exposed billions of dollars of financial fraud committed by banking giant UBS. He's the author of Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. And you can follow all of his work at lucifersbanker.com. Brad, welcome back.
Gentlemen, hi, good evening. Nice to be back on the show and from cold and snowy London.
John, I think they want to get rid of the Volcker Rule and have something called the Vulture Rule.
Yeah, well, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? Because if you look at the Volcker Rule, it very clearly and very plainly protects American consumers. It protects bank customers. And it protects them from speculation, which is just a nice way of saying gambling. Brad, what's this all about?
Well, what we've got here is a couple of things. The first thing is the shareholders of these banks should be up in arms saying, wait a minute, we don't want you to be taking speculative bets and gambling with the assets of the firm. That's the first thing. The second thing is the taxpayers of the United States should be outraged because they're tired of bailing out these banks for rolling the dice on these games that they've been playing. Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan claims it'll be so restrictive and so forth. Well, you haven't learned your lesson, Jamie. The fact is that you've been ripping off the American taxpayers so that you can play this game. The game's over, Jamie. It's time for these rules to stay in place so that people can be protected, not only the shareholders, but the taxpayers, because they haven't learned their lesson.
You know, I can't help but to think that if bankers had been prosecuted in 2009, 2010, when they were crashing the economy and bursting the housing bubble, that we wouldn't even be having this conversation. But because no one paid any price for ripping off the average American, they think that they can push back on these reforms. You know, I'm looking at a piece in MarketWatch today, and it says that U.S. regulators are taking another look at the Volcker Rule. So it's not even necessarily Congress. It's not even as though the average American has a voice in this kind of thing. And it says here, the new Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, told Congress, quote, we're taking a fresh look at the Volcker Rule. But why? Why in the world would they take a fresh look at the
Volcker
Rule?
And it wasn't just that these bankers weren't punished. They were rewarded.
They were.
The so-called Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008 allowed the government to buy $700 billion of distressed assets. So these banks that have been declared too big to fail and the bankers too big to jail would in fact be rewarded because they got that money with no strings attached.
Well, that's it. And you know, the thing is, again, it's like a child that misbehaves. The parents punish them. Well, the problem is the government never punished the banks. And they allow them to continue this. So, number one, it set a very bad precedent. And number two, there's no deterrent. So you're going to continue doing this nefarious acts. Why? Because you can get away with it, not only from your shareholders, not only from the taxpayers, but the regulators aren't going to come after you. So why would you stop? And that's why this rule has to stay in place.
Yeah, let's also talk about exactly what it is that the banks want to do. It says here that that with this so-called modification, they want to eliminate big banks' responsibility to prove that they do not trade on their own account. That's first. Second, they want to not be prevented from making risky market bets while accepting taxpayer insured deposits, which is exactly what led in part to the crash of the economy a few years ago. And they want to be able to make risky investments, even if those investments do not benefit their own customers. So really what they're trying to do is to use your money and my money to enrich themselves. And then if they lose the money, we're the ones who are out of luck.
Well, that's it. And I think what you've got here is you've got a system totally out of control. The regulators have to put a stamp to this. Congress should wake up immediately and say, you haven't learned your lesson. The American people are furious over this type of thing. And quite frankly, if the banks are that big, you know, then break down the banks, because what it says is on one side, they'll say, oh, well, they're too big to jail. On the other side is, well, if you do this, you'll destroy the whole market. The market economy, they destroyed by their actions. That's the whole problem. You know, whether it's the chicken or the egg here, you have a whole system of people that have actually undermined the entire economic system to their own benefit.
Brian, there's a group, a consortium of governmental organizations that that is supposed to enforce this thing. It's the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, or Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. They all have joint responsibility for enforcing it. And then one of the bankers involved said that there's unanimity on a need to act. And he says that there is this unanimity because the Volcker Rule is more than 1,000 pages long, and it's just simply too burdensome for them to have to follow it.
They can't figure it out. It's too complicated.
It's too complicated. And he says that it also depresses investment in certain asset classes. So, Brad, who cares if it depresses, not investment, but volume, trade volume? Why would that matter?
Well, here's the thing. It says that these guys want to churn this and make money off of these trades. And the fact of the matter is, it says, well, find another avenue to make your trades in then. If you don't like it or if it's too complicated, oh, it's sort of complicated, like those derivatives that you were selling the world to, which brought the whole financial crisis to its knees. So the fact of the matter is that they want it both ways here. The banks say, oh, well, we want less regulations, but we still want to roll the dice on these bets. No, that's not the way it works. And if you really feel as though you're that big that you can never be touched, well, then, quite frankly, maybe your bank should be broken in half or in thirds or whatever. And the problem is the people in those agencies you mentioned, the FDIC and OCC and SEC and so forth, these people go back and forth. They go from the public sector to the private sector. This revolving door is there. So, of course, they've got a self-interest here to pad and line their own pockets. It's the shareholders, the taxpayers, and the Congress who should be outraged and say, no, we're not changing this. If anything, we're going to make it stricter on you. And if you don't like it, well, then find something else to do, because this is not tolerable.
Brad is completely right. You know, we live in a country that's of by, well, it's not of and by, but it's certainly for the banks. And just to talk about the consolidation of bank power and what it means. The savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s was about 1/70th the size of the bank crisis that torpedoed the economy in 2007-2008, 1/70th. During that time, savings and loan regulators made 30,000 criminal referrals to the Department of Justice, 30,000. And there were over 1,000 felony convictions in cases designated as major by the DOJ. Just think about that.
1,000 major felony convictions.
And 30,000 criminal referrals. And now we have a crisis that was 70 times bigger, and the magnitude of the suffering was 70 times greater, again, borne by working folks, people who lost their homes or people who lost their jobs. I don't think there's been one criminal referral. Has there, Brad?
No. The only criminal referral was myself. And what they did was they attacked the whistleblower, because what I did was I literally dropped the pants of the DOJ and said, look, America, look, the world, these are the guys who should have uncovered this tax fraud going on for decades. They didn't do it. This is the guy, myself, who came in by myself and exposed the largest and longest running tax fraud in the world. And by the way, all these rich people, the politicians, the billionaires, the CEOs who were giving to these political campaigns said, stuff this guy. So the fact of the matter is, why is it that we cannot have whistleblowers come forward to help society become a better place? Because America is strangled by the government who's holding the purse strings.
You know, and let's remind people that as soon as you blew the whistle on this waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality, you went straight into the criminal justice system and then to prison, because that's what they do with whistleblowers. They want to be left alone to lie, steal, and cheat. And then when somebody blows the whistle, it's the whistleblower who gets punished.
And that's the problem with the system in America. And everyone in Europe, and I live in Europe now, and I still love America, but I don't like the system, because in Europe, the Europeans keep saying, what's wrong with your government? Why would the same government put you in jail and then pay you the largest award in history of $104 million? They just don't understand it. So you can see the dichotomy here. And what I'm trying to push for, and I think, John, you would say the same thing, also being a whistleblower, is to be able to say, wait a minute, let's put strong whistleblowing protections in place and compensate people who expose the waste, fraud, and corruption in our society. And this reverts right back to what we're talking about with this Volcker Rule, to say, no, we don't want to go down this path again, because we're going to go right back into the abyss, and the taxpayer and the shareholders of these banks are going to pay for it. No.
Brad, we've got about a minute left. I want to ask you, is this a fait accompli, or is there something that the American people can do to make sure that the Volcker Rule and Dodd-Frank remains unchanged?
I would say that everyone listening to your show and all the Americans who have been harmed by this financial crisis of 2008 should step up and call their senator, call their congresswoman or man, and say, look, we don't want this change, and you better stand up for it. And the people who claim to be standing up against the banks better really show their true colors now, because quite frankly, if you allow this thing to go to the wayside, well then, you know, you might as well just throw your hands up, because the whole system is corrupted then. Forget it.
John, because people don't have a long memory, unless you are one of the people deeply affected, you might not remember the human suffering that was caused. 9 million families went into foreclosure. 3 million lost their homes. 3 million families lost their homes during that time period. About 20 million people lost their jobs as the economy went down, down, down. And yet we have, you know, the bankers got $700 billion and then $7 trillion when you think about loan guarantees. And again, no criminal referrals. And now they think, well, the system's just too harsh on us.
Right. It's 1,000 pages is too long. It's
too complicated.
Too complicated. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Brad Birkenfeld. Brad is a whistleblower who exposed billions of dollars of financial fraud committed by banking giant UBS. He's also the author of Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. And you can follow all of his work at lucifersbanker.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump told a group of senators yesterday that he favored stronger background checks for gun purchasers and was open to the idea of raising to 21 the age necessary to buy a gun. The National Rifle Association, in the meantime, was lobbying hard on Capitol Hill to either kill or water down any new gun control legislation. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. And we're also joined from Chicago by Robert Kohler. He's an award-winning journalist and nationally syndicated writer and the author of the book Courage Grows Strong at the Wound. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob, I'd like to start with you. You just recently published a piece in Common Dreams at commondreams.org called The Cheapening of Human Life. Tell us about that.
It was in response to the Parkland shootings and, you know, in response to the, you know, the moving, you know, heart-rending protests by the young people from Parkland and elsewhere that don't want, you know, their schools shot up. And my feeling is that it's just not enough to talk about, you know, tiny little, you know, twists and turns in gun legislation, because we live in a society, I mean, as I said in the column, that is cheapening the value of human life. I mean, if life is sacred, and, you know, and we all know that it is at some deep level. And when there's something like a horrible shooting, the shock is like, oh my God, there's a horrible violation of something has just occurred.
Let's get Wilmer Leon in on this. Wilmer, let's talk about Trump's meeting with senators yesterday. He said that he said, you know why? Meaning why they're hesitant to pass gun control? Because you're afraid of the NRA. Now, that's the National Rifle Association. Now, that's Trump saying, you guys are more afraid of the NRA, as he said, but I'm not. Uh-huh. And he was proposing older, you know, 21 years for gun purchases, bigger background checks. He was also talking about violating people's due process rights, just to make mention that the police should seize people's firearms and worry about due process later, which, of course, is unconstitutional. But it was, you know, it was typical Trump. But of course, the NRA today is going crazy. And they issued a statement saying this makes for good TV, but it's bad for policy.
Right.
The NRA probably is feeling a little bit worried right now. Go ahead, Wilmer.
I don't think that Wayne LaPierre and his henchmen are concerned at all. You have to take Donald Trump's statements with less than a grain of salt, because what he said yesterday, he will disavow tomorrow. I think that really that this issue is being discussed in the wrong context. We always bring up gun control after a horrific mass shooting. What should be discussed is gun control in the larger context of the number of people that are killed by firearms in this country every day, which mass shootings is a subset. So if you talk about the larger issue of how are we going to make America a safer country, then your discussion is different than what do we do to keep automatic weapons out of the hands of maniacs who want to go in and shoot up theaters, schools, and churches.
I totally agree with you on that. There's no question. But we just wanted to bounce off of this surprise, because up until now, Donald Trump has been very much in partnership with the NRA. He's been in partnership with the gun lobby, which is very strong. And of course, the gun lobby always talks about the Second Amendment, you know, in the Constitution. All they really want to do is get ever richer by selling weapons of all types. And now we have a sort of a pushback going on. You have Dick's Sporting Goods and some other major box store, Walmart, saying that they're not going to sell automatic weapons. And you have Trump, who is also adjusting his position. And as he adjusts his position, he's criticizing the Republican Party senators, and he's criticizing the NRA, or he's ridiculing them. I'm just wondering from both of you, we'll start with Bob and then go back to Wilmer. Aside from the fact that gun control isn't actually going to solve the problem of mass gun violence, or then, as Wilmer's pointing out, the regular gun violence, which may not be mass shootings. But aside from efficacy, I want to just talk about the politics. Do you think there's something changing politically that could be affecting Trump, too? Go ahead.
Well, I think Trump's role here is to create chaos. This is an example. Suddenly he swings, momentarily left on this issue, and throws the NRA into uproar and alarm for a moment. And I agree with Wilmer. This is not something we go, oh my God, you know, the presidents are on our side now. He's nowhere. He's just, you know, reacting, you know, and his mood in the moment. You know, but maybe there is some value in the chaos that Trump does bring. Since the Parkland shooting, the young people that have, you know, seem to be creating a movement, this may be something that pushes through, you know, and opens the larger issue, as Wilmer is talking about, that there is a large issue of gun violence across this country. And, of course, the availability of guns is the final straw. But before that, you know, there are all these, all this violence and celebration of violence, which is one of my big issues, you know, in the media and, of course, in the military. You know, the military budget is, two-thirds of what we, you know, spend our national treasure on. You know, so anybody that has an issue will turn himself into an army of one to solve the problem, just the way we solve our big problem.
The guns are out there. I have a cousin, a first cousin, on Facebook a couple of days ago. He said on Facebook, "Hey, I have 3 AR-15s. I don't need 3. Message me if you want, one or two of them." And I messaged him, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I don't need 3. I need 1." I said, "What do you need 1 for? Why in the world would you have 3 AR-15s?" And he couldn't even answer. But that's America. That's America. And you know, I want to ask Wilmer his opinion on this too. There's a piece today, Wilmer, on CNN.com. It's as though Trump is taunting these senators, and he's saying that major gun policy changes would not present a political risk because, quote, it would be so easy to get 60 votes. That would be, unquote, that would be necessary to avoid a filibuster. Well, 60 votes is difficult always, even if something's not controversial. I wonder if he's saying this knowing that the Senate is going to fail, because everybody's got an opinion and every one of them is different. And then he can come back and say, listen, I tried to get gun control, but these Democrats in the Senate, they couldn't agree on anything, and it's on them. Wilmer, what do you think about that?
I think you're trying to assign logic to an illogical mind, and you're trying to assign, you're very sensible in dealing with a unsensible individual. Just as the president has made his most recent statements, he has still stuck to the language of hardening our targets, which is Wayne LaPierre's language.
Yes.
And he's also still sticking to the ridiculous idea of arming teachers.
Right.
And so he's, to me, that shows you that just how totally whack the guy is. Because when you start talking about arming teachers, it fails on a number of fronts, but the two most prominent of those are deterrent and response. When the president starts talking about, well, right now schools are gun-free zones and everybody knows that they are, so people feel safe, you know, walking into a school with an AR-15, and by arming teachers now, the perpetrator will think differently. Well, that's assuming you're dealing with a rational actor.
That's right.
Anybody who wants to take an AR-15 into a school and shoot up a school is not a rational actor. In fact, what you're probably doing is creating the scenario where that individual feels, I now need to meet greater force with even greater force, which is going to make for an even more catastrophic. And that on the response side, you don't want teachers in hallways pulling out guns and shooting at people. I mean, you've got reports from the New York Times that show the NYPD only hits its target 29% of the time. The LAPD, they hit their target 27% of the time. And you've got Ray Kelly, who says that those numbers are good numbers when you factor in all the other elements that are involved in shooting at an adversary.
Yeah, just think about it, John. I mean, teachers, they have to hand out their assignments. They have to worry about students who are at different levels. They have to grade exams. They have to get ready for the next day. And now they have to go to target practice so they don't shoot students by mistake.
We also know historically, when you inject additional force into a situation, it is people of color that wind up becoming disproportionately victimized by that increased force.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
Robert, we're going to give you the last word. We have about 30, 40 seconds.
Yes, all I could say was at least the kids may be less likely to talk on their cell phones during class if the teacher's armed. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. The whole, that, you know, issue is insane, and the chaos continues, and, you know, there's no rational sense of how to deal with this.
Yeah, so if you shoot a couple students by mistake, I mean, can you imagine what would happen in this country?
Oh, my God.
If you have teachers armed and trying to respond to a crisis situation. I mean, it turned out the deputy sheriffs wouldn't even go into the building.
He ran for his life.
They ran for their lives.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Washington by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 126. And we're joined from Chicago by Robert Kohler. He is an award-winning journalist and nationally syndicated writer, and he's also the author of the book Courage Grows Strong at the Wound. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russian President Vladimir Putin today laid out his key policies ahead of a presidential election that he's expected to win handily in 17 days. He also made the bombshell announcement that Russia has developed a cruise missile that can reach anywhere in the world, it can carry a nuclear warhead, and it's impossible to shoot down. We're joined from London by Alexander Makuris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran, and he just got back from Moscow. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Alexander, this speech received very wide play in the United States today. Virtually every radio station that I listened to this morning was playing the English translation of it, and it seems that that Putin's audience really was here in the United States rather than his domestic Russian audience.
But before you start, I want to read this thing from the New York Times, and sort of it helps you understand, Alexander, what John's talking about, the media coverage of Putin's speech. Here's from the New York Times. Quote, given that deception lies at the heart of current Russian military doctrine, questions were raised about whether this advanced new generation of nuclear weapons actually exists. Wow, you know, America's military is so open.
Oh,
it's
yes.
So transparent.
Oh, yes, yes.
Unlike the Russians, who at their heart in their military affairs. Yeah,
deceptive.
It's deception. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I think the first point to make about that is that it is an extremely dangerously complacent out of view. It's not so long ago, as I very well remember, that the people in the West were basically discounting the Russian military, were saying that it was old-fashioned, ineffective, that it had fallen far behind technologically. And then, of course, Syria came, and we saw it in action there, and it turned out that none of those things were true. So I think to assume that President Putin is engaging in some sort of deception or con trick by talking about all of these weapons that he showcased today, is reckless. It also, I think, however, shows the degree of dismay, if one wishes, in the U.S. that they are, for the first time since the Cold War, back in a nuclear arms race. And if you read the Nuclear Posture Review that the United States military itself published a short time ago, it made exactly that point. Now, the problem is that we are, again, in an arms race. It is all extremely worrying and very dangerous. But the United States needs to do some very hard thinking. Because the other thing that President Putin went out of his way to say repeatedly in his speech is that these steps which the Russians are taking to develop all these new weapons were made in response to actions taken by the United States.
Which does not appear in the U.S. press, by the way.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, he makes the point. It was the United States that decided to withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It was the United States that decided to extend NATO into the former territories of the Warsaw Pact. It is the United States that has pursued regime change policies around the world. It is the United States that has created anti-ballistic missile systems and is planting them in Eastern Europe and on the Korean Peninsula and in the United States itself. So the Russians have felt obliged to make responses to those actions. And one of the things that President Putin said was that, of course, the United, and this touches on the point in the New York Times article, that the United States never expected that Russia would be able to make those responses because of the extent to which Russia in the early 2000s was still in an economic and social crisis. And it took all of those steps Russia took all of those steps in order to respond to those actions. And yet from the New York Times article, it seems that the U.S. is still in denial about the fact that the Russians are able to respond to U.S. moves in this way.
Yeah, you know, all through the Cold War, at least in the beginning, Russia, or it was then the Soviet Union, was considered by the U.S. to be a backward, poor, illiterate, peasant country until, boom, Sputnik. The Soviets showed their, you know, profound technological prowess in spite of limited resources, in spite of the fact that it was still a poor country, to be able to be the first country to orbit in outer space. And they did it again. And that set off the first arms race because of the hubris and arrogance of the United States. They thought, well, this country is so low, it's so down, they can never challenge us. And as soon as they showed that they could challenge, then the U.S. went berserk. I mean, it really created, in the United States, a hysteria, as if the world was coming to an end. The sky was falling because of Sputnik. It's hard to overstate the emotional and psychological impact of that. But Alexander's right. This is because, and Putin made it quite clear today when he was emphasizing all of the new weapon systems, that nobody, meaning the West, meaning the United States, was taking Russia seriously, listening to Russia, or treating Russia as anything but a punching bag over all these years, and expecting, demanding that Russia return, say, to the 1995 period when it was on its knees. And Yeltsin is making it quite clear with this statement. I think it's a profoundly important statement. Guess what? We're back. We're not going to be pushed around. You better believe us this time. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I think you've summed it up extremely well. And this is what Putin not only said, but he also, I think this is the thing which I suspect, I haven't read the American media, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but he also emphasized that he not only wants the United States to listen to Russia, he actually wants the United States to start engaging with Russia again. He does not want to see an indefinite arms race go on. But if the Russians are pushed, that's what will happen. And that's inevitably what's going to happen. And I ought to say, again, it's all very well for the New York Times and for certain people in the media and on the internet community in the United States to deny all this is happening. But if you go back a few weeks and read the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review, which the Pentagon itself has published, you will find there an admission on the part of the Pentagon itself that this arms race is underway and that the U.S. is itself going to have to respond to it in exactly the way you said. So, yes, we could very soon be on the brink of another Sputnik moment, and so avoidable.
You know, let's talk, too, about what you said, Brian, that this attitude that somehow Russia's beneath us. I'm looking at Bloomberg, which I actually like. I don't agree necessarily with Bloomberg's opinion pages, but I find it to be a reputable, reliable news source. The headline on this article today is Putin wants modern weapons, not modern Russia. And the subheading is the president's key speech was full of unfunded promises and thinly veiled threats. That's Cold War language.
Yeah, it's dripping with animus.
It really is. It's dripping with animus. And the point of this is that we should not take the Russians seriously. But if we do take the Russians seriously, we have to fight them. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I mean, it's not only dripping with animus. It's also completely wrong. If you look at Russia's financial situation at the moment, it is actually much stronger than that of the U.S. The U.S. has a debt to GDP ratio of over 100%. Russia has one of 15%. They are moving towards a balanced budget. They are in a position to afford an arms race. Obviously, from their point of view, it's not what they would like to do. But it is a complete misconception that if they're put into an arms race situation, they cannot sustain it. I would add, and this again touches on the Bloomberg piece, that obviously an awful lot of the rest of the article, a speech today that was made today by President Putin, touched on domestic economic issues. But again, it is a complete fallacy to speak of it all as unfunded promises. He sets out very clearly where the funding for these various economic programs are going to come from, and they can, again, come from the very careful budgeting that has been the hallmark of the whole time that he has been president. It is delusional to go on thinking about Russia in this way, and it is very dangerous.
And Russia spends one-tenth, and probably actually less than one-tenth of what the U.S. spends on the military, because there's other cited parts of the military and defense spending structure that go far beyond the $716 billion that's the official defense budget. Mr. Putin said, Alexander, quote, "We would consider any use of nuclear weapons against Russia or its allies to be a nuclear attack on our country. The response would be immediate." Now, that's pretty strong. And also, it seems to me the only reason Putin, who actually wants to have improved relations with the United States, the only reason he's talking like that is based on the Nuclear Posture Review and the nuclear strategic documents that have come out in recent weeks and what Russia can observe. They really believe that the U.S. is preparing, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point in the future, and maybe not too far in the future, for an attack using tactical nuclear weapons against countries that may be the allies of Russia or against Russia itself. Go ahead. We have 1 minute left.
That's exactly right, because it was what the Nuclear Posture Review and the Strategic Defense Document spoke about is that the United States facing multiple challenges around the world, not just from Russia, but from China, too, in the Pacific, from Iran, in the Middle East, from all sorts of places. And, of course, the U.S. military, powerful, overwhelmingly powerful though it is not so strong that it can take on all these adversaries at the same time. So we are looking now to a situation where the U.S. is going to use low-yield nuclear weapons to make up for its conventional inferiority in particular theaters. That's where we're heading towards, which, of course, very dangerously lowers the nuclear threshold. And in order to justify doing that, they have invented an entirely fictional a Russian plan for limited nuclear war, which does not exist, but which almost certainly refers to their own plans. Very dangerous indeed.
We are going to have to leave it right there. We were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
White House Communications Director Hope Hicks resigned yesterday, hours after testifying on Capitol Hill in the Russia investigation. Hicks is only one of more than two dozen senior White House officials who have resigned in the past year. Meanwhile, Attorney General Sessions responded tersely to President Trump's angry tweet about his handling of the investigation and to Trump's comparison of Sessions to the cartoon character Mr. Magoo. Brian, it really is chaos at the White House. I have to tell you, in President Trump's tweets just about Jeff Sessions. Now, remember, Jeff Sessions was the first senator to endorse Donald Trump for president. So he was in from the beginning and he was loyal, which the president, I guess, values more than anything else. But in separate tweets, Trump has called Jeff Sessions disgraceful, weak, beleaguered, an idiot, and Mr. Magoo. What the heck do we make out of that? And why in the world is Jeff Sessions still attorney general?
Well, and Jeff Sessions is obviously doing his own pushback here because
he went out to
have dinner the other day. Let's talk about that.
He went out with Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who's also beleaguered and has been attacked by the president. He also refused comment on being called Mr. Magoo. I'm not sure I fully understand the Mr. Magoo insult. Mr. Magoo was blind. But would still drive and get into car accidents and see things that weren't there or not see things that were there. I'm not quite sure I get the connection, but either way, it's clear that this is an insult.
There's something that Sessions and Trump have, you know, going for them, which is they're both xenophobes. They're both extremely hostile to the immigrant communities. They're both perceived in the black and brown communities as people who are, you know, hostile. Sessions himself, when he was nominated by Ronald Reagan to become federal district court from Alabama, was too racist and couldn't pass through the Senate. So even Reagan had to withdraw his nomination. He's now the top law enforcement officer of the country.
Yep.
I mean, he's a reactionary. He's anti-woman. He's against women's rights. He's against abortion rights. He's certainly all excited about the fact that his agents can go around and raid and arrest and deport or hold in custody for indefinite periods of time immigrant families. There's a lot of things that you can say that are bad about Jeff Sessions, and those are the same things that we would say are bad about Donald Trump. But this is an apparent rupture or a continuing rupture within the administration, and it comes just after, you know, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who's in charge of the vast real estate of Kushner companies. They're going around the world doing business right now. The company is, Jared is no longer officially with the company. But every time he goes and meets with somebody, or not every time, but it seems like many times, then there's new investments flowing into the Kushner camp. You can go through the list of all the people who have been fired. Hope Hicks, the communications director, resigned after Trump berated her yesterday. We don't know if that's the reason. she went before House committees or was it House or Senate committees where she was saying that she told white lies on behalf of Trump.
Right. Which infuriated him, apparently.
That's an interesting approach for a communications director. Yeah, I lie. Of course I lie. But they're white lies. They're small lies. They're harmless lies. They're small lies for a good and better cause. But here we have a real falling out with Sessions. And let's talk about that. Why Trump is actually angry with Jeff Sessions.
I think this all comes back to the Russia investigation. Trump is still furious that Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. He expected Jeff Sessions to show blind loyalty and to try to kill this investigation while it was still in its crib. But Sessions, being an attorney and being an old hand in Washington, knew that that would be political suicide.
And protecting himself.
That's right. And he was protecting himself.
John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, John, said that his departure from the Department of Homeland Security as secretary to become chief of staff at the White House was punishment from God. He said he did something wrong and God punished me, I guess, talking about why and what happened when he left the Department of Homeland Security to become chief of staff for Donald Trump at the White House. I did something wrong and God punished me, I guess. That's John Kelly.
You know, the job of a White House chief of staff, it's the most important job in the entire White House, but the job is to act as gatekeeper for the president. It's the chief of staff who decides what calls the president takes, what calls the president makes. He decides who gets to physically get inside the Oval Office. I mean, you can be working right there in proximity to the Oval Office, and if the chief of staff doesn't want you to have access to the president, you don't have access. You can't just walk in to the Oval Office, no matter who you are, and meet with the president. So the idea behind that is that you are able then to run a professional White House. The problem for General Kelly or former General Kelly is that the president just acts on his own. He tweets in the middle of the night. He'll pick up the phone and call his old friends in New York and complain to them about his day. And then they in turn will call journalists and say, hey, the president just told me XYZ, he was complaining about his day. And then Trump jumps up and down because somehow the information has leaked and he wants to find the leakers and punish them. In fact, he's the leaker. And so it's a no-win situation for General Kelly. He comes out of this looking very bad.
I mean, what we're witnessing, I believe, in the Trump White House is this toxic combination of very corrupt people. There, maybe it's not corrupt because it's the United States. I mean, what anywhere else in the world would be called corruption, criminal activity? In America, it's called lobbying, or it's called the free market or self-interest or something. I mean, we have a New York Times article from just February 28th from yesterday. Kushner's family business received loans after White House meetings. Apollo, the private equity firm and Citigroup, made large loans last year to the family real estate business of Jared Kushner, President Trump's senior advisor. Okay, that's, you know, it speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Well, it speaks for this, the appearance of impropriety, because that's the threshold. That's the criteria. You can't always prove that somebody did something for somebody else because they got paid. In other words, pay to play. But it's the appearance, and that's why there's this broader criteria or threshold that politicians or these agents in the White House are not supposed to be appearing to be corrupt. Now Kushner has lost, and he's going around the world with this large portfolio, and it's sort of like he's the key foreign affairs guy for the Trump administration. In the meantime, his family business is getting loans every time he meets with somebody, in this case Citigroup or Apollo, the private equity firm. You have Donald Trump himself, who is the Trump International Hotel, and there's been lots of reports that foreign governments want to come and stay at the Trump Hotel so that when they meet with somebody in the White House later that day, they can say, oh, we stayed at the Trump Hotel, of course.
Yeah, in fact, almost every Arab country has had its National Day celebration at the Trump Hotel.
Yeah, so you have that toxic combination of people who are out for themselves, the Trump administration trying to run the White House the way he ran the Trump Organization as a private sort of dictatorial force. The main sort of criteria about whether you lasted or not was just fidelity and loyalty to the boss. And if you didn't, he could, as he did on the reality TV show, The Apprentice, he could just fire you and have fun firing you. And there's been a lot of people fired. I mean, if you go through the list, This is an enormous number of staff members in the first year.
Enormous. Unprecedented.
Who have departed either because they've been fired or because they've been forced out, one or the other. But here you have Trump not really representing the, I would say, the general interests of the elites in America, as the presidency is supposed to do. Trump is basically looking out for Trump.
That's it.
And he's always been looking out for Trump. And that's why big parts of the political establishment, either on Wall Street or in Washington, in spite of the fact that Trump is a rich guy and will do more or less whatever they want, they still think he's not looking out for our interests. He's looking out for his interests. And so you have this narrow focus of the Trump administration, and people call that disloyalty. But really, that's who Trump is. That's what Trump has always been about. On the other side, Kelly, who's supposed to, you know, that caricature or that characterization that he was the adult in the room.
Right.
Well, from my point of view, John Kelly is a militarist. From my point of view, John Kelly has pursued a racist policy towards immigrants. Is that what being the adult in the room means? Or General McMaster or General Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis. These are the people who are in the past, the media has said, well, at least these are the stable people. But what makes them stable? I mean, they're representatives, really, of the generalized interests of the military-industrial complex and of Wall Street, not the narrow interests of a mid-sized real estate company.
And that does not go unnoticed within the Republican Party. Don't forget that there's a what's called a Never Trump movement in the Republican Party, where you've got dozens, maybe even hundreds of serious foreign policy thinkers who had served in the George W. Bush administration and who are refusing to serve in the Donald Trump administration. And so you get this turnover in the White House, just as one example, of these several dozen top aides, and then you can't even fill those slots with qualified people because so many people in your own party dislike you and disrespect you so much that they just won't work for you under any circumstances.
And then if you have Donald Trump and his daughter and his son-in-law having this tight sort of hold over the White House and, again, pursuing their own interests, and that's how it's perceived, that's why Kelly came in and reduced clearance for a lot of people. That's why he reduced access for a lot of people. That's why he treated Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner as just other staff people rather than members of the family, so to speak, because otherwise, the White House is completely untethered from the needs of the political and economic establishment, meaning the needs of the elites in America. If it's only pursuing the family business, that provides a foundational instability. And I think that's really what does explain not just Trump's maverick personality, but that kind of approach to governance explains some of the instability that we're witnessing every day, every hour.
Yep. I think you would agree that it's not going to get better in the near future. We are out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Love, love, love.